by the Whitehall Glens Falls. It's 8 o'clock.
Good morning. This is Northern Light for Wednesday, March 6th. I'm Monica Sandresky.
And I'm Todd Moe.
St. Lawrence County's only assisted living facility is closing. The closure will strain the county's overburdened elder care system.
So not having that, you know, puts these families in such a huge detriment of, well, what do we do? Mom or dad isn't safe at home, but I work full time. You know, I can't be a full time caregiver and they need 24/7 care.
Governor Hochul's budget director says there's a chance extra tax collections could soften the blow of cuts to school aid next year.
Also, forest rangers in the Adirondacks rescued two hikers simultaneously Saturday night on Saddleback and Basin Mountains.
The trails are just so narrow that when you're sliding them like we were, and you have people on either side kind of braking and steering, that if you step off of the packed portion of trail, you were sinking into waist-deep snow.
And Chef Curtis Hem shares a recipe for maple season, maple teriyaki salmon.
All that's coming up on Northern Light. Stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by Point Positive, offering entrepreneurs the support they need to start and accelerate their ventures through mentoring, education, and startup funding. PointPositiveADK.com. And by Blue Seed Studios, a multidisciplinary arts center featuring classes for adults and youth, concerts, art exhibits, and more. BLUSeedStudios.org.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandresky.
And I'm Todd Moe. A new commanding general will lead Fort Drum and the 10th Mountain Division. The Watertown Daily Times reports Major General Scott Nauman will take over the position this summer. Nauman is currently serving as the Deputy Chief of Staff at Fort Liberty, formerly known as Fort Bragg in North Carolina. He'll replace Commanding General Gregory Anderson. Anderson has held the post for less than 2 years.
And the city of Burlington has elected its first LGBTQ plus mayor. Progressive candidate Emma Mulvaney-Stanek is also the city's first female mayor. According to Vermont Public, Mulvaney-Stanek currently serves on the State House of Representatives and runs a social change consulting business. The big issue in the mayor's race was public safety. Mulvaney-Stanek's approach is to address systemic issues like drug addiction and homelessness. She bested Democrat Joan Shannon in the race. Shannon urged her supporters last night to support Mulvaney-Stanek as mayor.
Last month, St. Lawrence County's only assisted living facility announced it would be closing its doors. United Helpers says it's had to find new homes for 34 people living at its assisted living program in Canton. The company's independent living and skilled nursing programs on its Maplewood campus aren't affected. Catherine Wheeler reports the closure adds stress to the county's overburdened elder care system.
United Helpers says it was a difficult decision to close its assisted living facility in Canton, but there were a few factors making it hard to carry on.
This was really due to our low reimbursement rates, our increased cost, and staffing shortages.
Jordan Downing-Duke is United Helpers' Assistant Director for Corporate Services.
All of those factors led to really an unsustainable model for United Helpers to be able to continue to operate our assisted living program in Canton.
The facility is scheduled to close in mid-May, and the closure exposes a systemic problem for the region's elder care system. Andrea Montgomery is the director of the St. Lawrence County Office for the Aging. She says she's been hearing about the same issues for years.
Absolutely. They are not getting reimbursed at a high enough rate, certainly not for the level of care that they have and the staffing. We've all had a ton of trouble since we've come out of COVID trying to recruit and retain staff.
United Helpers in Canton was St. Lawrence County's only assisted living facility. And Montgomery says this stage of care is really important. It's a step before higher levels of care, like a nursing home.
So not having that, you know, puts these families in such a huge detriment of, well, what do? Mom or dad isn't safe at home, but I work full time. You know, I can't be a full time caregiver, and they need 24/7 care. They need, you know, someone there to watch over them.
There are wait lists for the handful of nursing homes. And for people who want to stay in their own homes, Montgomery says there's a huge shortage of aides for in-home care. Montgomery says that leads to older residents having to leave the county for placement at any kind of facility.
And that's really hard on the families. You know, oftentimes they can't travel for regular visits. We've had someone go as far as just outside of New York City. Based on the care level they need, that was the closest facility that could help them.
Montgomery says the baby boomer generation is aging, and they'll need programs and services that are nearly impossible to find now. She says people and lawmakers should advocate for more state and federal funding for elder care because there just isn't enough now. Catherine Wheeler, North Country Public Radio in Canton.
The village of Potsdam is planning to sue a local landlord for allegedly not holding proper rental permits. North Country Now reports village trustees approved pursuing legal action against Steve Bond at a recent meeting. Bond owns several storefronts and other buildings in downtown Potsdam on Market, Elm, and Main Streets, including the former Backstreets Bar. The Potsdam Village Code Enforcer says the properties don't have rental permits, which could pose a danger for tenants and the community. Rentals must be inspected every 3 years to get a permit. The planned suit comes as the village is working on its downtown revitalization improvement plan with $10 million from the state. It includes funds for fixing historic buildings and improving walkability and housing. A village official says Bond has been sent applications for the funds to make improvements, but has not acknowledged them.
One of the most controversial aspects of Governor Hochul's state budget has been the cuts to school aid. Almost half of the schools here in the North Country face a budget cut under the governor's proposal. Yesterday in Albany, Hochul's budget director defended her proposed reductions to the state schools, but he left the door open to restoring those cuts now that new numbers show New York's revenues are up by $1.3 billion. Karen DeWitt spoke to budget director Blake Washington on a very busy day at the state capitol.
I know you don't like to call them cuts, but half of the school districts would lose money under the plan. There's bipartisan opposition to it. In fact, the Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins said today that she's very concerned about these reductions. Can you make the case for why you decided to put them that way in the budget?
Sure. So when you look at the governor's budget proposal, The school districts with the year-to-year reduction or the year-to-year change are fully funded under the foundation formula as envisioned 15 years ago. They have exceeded that amount in some cases by double-digit percentage amounts. And at the same time, those school districts, 75% of the school districts have lost 20% or more of their student body in that same period of time. So the proposals to rationalize where the resources are going, making sure we're not paying for empty seats, but also channel resources to the high needs and growing districts. So that's the overall thrust of the governor's proposal.
But you're also trying to take away something that's been kind of sacred in Albany, and that's known as Halt Harmless or Save Harmless provision that says no school district can get less money than they did the previous year. And so that has caused some controversy. Also, the inflation adjustment that you're doing, a 10-year average instead of what the actual rate of inflation was from last year to this year, which is quite high.
That's right. So, I mean, maybe if we could just start from the beginning, this budget closes a $4.3 billion gap, and that doesn't come easy. And there's only a couple of places that have a significant amount of state share spending, and that's one of those is in school aid.
Right.
So trying to first acknowledge that under Governor Hochul's leadership, the last 2 years under her first two budgets, the governor has put forward $5 billion in school aid increases to the same school districts.
You had the revenue forecasting meeting, I think it was a few days ago. You found, I think it was $1.3 billion in additional money. What I want to know is, how does that work? And is that something that we can do at home?
So it's funny. The way it works is the governor's budget comes out, is put out in mid-January. And during that same time, tax returns are coming into the state of New York, so we're realizing tax returns in real time. The governor's proposal sets a series of assumptions, and then through this process, that month that goes by, give or take, you can actually see the actuals coming in. So the discussion that we have among us and our legislative colleagues is, where is the governor's proposal at that moment in time? How has it improved or weakened since that moment in time? And that's the number that we agree upon, that 1.3.
Yeah, so I was being flippant. But this is from additional revenues, right, that have come up.
Precisely. Tax largely collections. Through personal income tax collections that we didn't necessarily, that we did not project as high as this. So this rectifies and allows for new resources to come into the state's financial plan to smooth out the rough edges even on the governor's proposal.
So there could be some restorations from the governor's budget. It sounds like you have a little bit more money to do that.
Absolutely. And we'll be looking forward to working with the legislature to do just that. We want to make sure that the restorations we do are sustainable in the long term. And, you know, less recurring is the better, is better for us for our long term out year gaps. But all the same, that's the part and parcel of this is how much money do you have on hand and how can we improve upon the executive proposal?
That's New York State Budget Director Blake Washington speaking with New York Public News Network Albany correspondent Karen DeWitt.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. It's 8:11. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Coming up, Champlain Valley chef Curtis Hem shares his favorite salmon recipe for maple syrup season. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on Northern Light.
Music by Tim Elifritz in Johnsburg. Check out more of his music anytime on our website, ncpr.org/_. Northern Light is supported by Mountain Orthotic and Prosthetic Services, a full-service practice committed to providing care for patients of all ages with offices in Lake Placid, Plattsburgh, and Malone. Details and referrals at mountainonp.com. And by St. Lawrence Nurseries, Potsdam, accepting orders now through April 12th for cold hardy fruit and nut trees. Details at slngrow.com.
Forest rangers spent Saturday night on two separate rescues in the Adirondacks. Warm weather this winter has created difficult and dangerous conditions in the mountains for both hikers and rescuers. Emily Russell reports.
The first call came in around 2:45 on Saturday afternoon. A group of people were climbing up Saddleback Mountain, that's in the Adirondack High Peaks, when one of them fell near the summit. He dislocated his shoulder and fractured his leg. Audrey Emerson is one of the forest rangers who was on that rescue.
That part of the mountain is extremely steep, nearly vertical, and just huge broken boulders and, you know, a sloped rock face that was all covered with glare ice and snow.
It's a 7-mile climb to the summit. The first wave of rangers reached the injured hiker after 8 p.m. One of them posted a video on Instagram showing nearly whiteout conditions. Emerson was part of the second wave of rangers to reach the group. By that time, she says, luckily the wind and snow had died down.
These conditions could have been much worse, so I was thinking in the back of my head, you know, I'm thankful that it's not below zero. I'm thankful that the wind's not whipping right now and it's not snowing. And just I kept thinking about all the things that could have been 10 times worse.
Still, rangers had to do a technical rope rescue to maneuver the injured man off the steep slope. As they prepared for that rescue, a second call came in. A hiker had fallen 30 feet while climbing Basin Mountain, just south of Saddleback. David Nally is a forest ranger who was on that rescue. Because the rescues were happening simultaneously, Nally says an incident commander coordinated both from the trailhead in Keene Valley.
As resources and rangers arrived, he assigned rangers and resources to either one of those rescues.
The basin rescue was less technical, but Nally says it came with its own set of challenges. It's been warmer at lower elevations this winter, creating uncomfortable conditions for the rangers.
You know, sometimes a little bit of cold isn't a bad thing because it, at least things are dry. When it's wet snow, like everything's wet and everything stays wet.
As a team of rangers over on Saddleback worked their way down the mountain, they too found wet, slushy snow and open water crossings. Audrey Emerson says that complicated the carry out.
The trails are just so narrow that when you're sliding them like we were, and you have people on either side kind of braking and steering, that if you step off of the packed portion of trail, you were sinking into waist-deep snow post-holing because we didn't have snowshoes on, and that just drains your energy throughout the whole time.
This winter has been one of the warmest on record in the Adirondacks. David Nally says that makes it more difficult for hikers to know what conditions they might encounter when in the mountains.
If you're in lower elevations, you could have an afternoon right now that's 60 degrees and sunny, you know, 50 degrees and sunny, and it's beautiful, and you could almost hike in a t-shirt. But then come evening, you're single digits and freezing temperatures. So it's a tough time to be out under these conditions.
The conditions in the Adirondacks and the variable weather this winter also may lead people to misjudge how long a hike could take them, which Emerson says is where some hikers get into trouble.
If you're planning your hike based on the conditions at the bottom and you think, oh, well, this is only going to take me a few hours, and then you get halfway up and you're too committed and stubborn and you realize this snow is really going to slow me down, then, you know, your night might look a lot different than what you expected.
It might also look a lot different for the forest rangers called up to help lost or injured hikers. More than 30 rangers responded to the two overnight rescues on Saturday. It was daylight Sunday by the time everyone was out of the woods safely. Emily Russell, North Country Public Radio.
The top professional mountain bikers in the world will travel to the Adirondacks this fall for competitions. Lake Placid will host a round of the UCI Mountain Bike World Series at Mount Van Hovenberg from September 27th to the 29th. It's one of 15 stops on the international tour. Over the past few years, the state has invested more than $550 million in the Olympic Regional Development Authority's facilities, including mountain bike trails. ORDA President Ashley Walden says it wouldn't be possible to host without the upgrades. Walden says this will be the first time in a mountain biking event of this size will come to the area. She says she hopes it'll bring in more non-winter athletic events. The Adirondack Explorer reported this past December that ORDA is paying $1.2 million to host the competitions each fall for 3 years. That covers the rights to host the event and marketing. ORDA will receive revenue from food, beverage and ticket sales, and part of the athlete competition fees. You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. In just a minute, grilled salmon with a saucy hook. Chef Curtis Hem shares the recipe. Then stick around after the show for Bird Note, using bird song to check a river's health. That's coming up at 8:42. First, Todd has a look at the weather for us.
Clouds and rain showers today, highs in the 40s, near 50, with winds out of the north-northeast, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Maybe a wintry mix tonight. Temperatures falling into the 30s overnight tonight. Tomorrow, partly cloudy, a high near 50. And then sunshine on Friday with highs upper 40s, low 50s. And it looks like a chance of rain again this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, with highs in the 40s on Saturday. Right now we've got clouds and 44 degrees here in Canton.
It's maple syrup season, and Chef Curtis Hem says his recipe for maple glazed salmon is one of the easiest, with hints of soy sauce and sake that complement the sweet maple. Chef Curtis is the former Dean of Culinary Arts at the New England Culinary Institute in Burlington. These days, he and his family live in Peru, New York, where he runs the Carriage House Cooking School and is the executive chef at the View Restaurant at the Mirror Lake Inn Resort and Spa in Lake Placid. And he joins us each month to share a favorite recipe.
Chef Curtis's fusion sauce combines Japanese soy sauce with rice vinegar, sake, and maple syrup. He says it's a flavorful sauce worth putting on everything.
It's that perfect combination of a little bit of Asian flavor with local food, being the maple syrup. And any chance I have really to focus on maple in the spring, I do. I really enjoy it. I think it's just one of our best local products anyway. So I guess accessibility to food. So having salmon, herbs are pretty guaranteed in most grocery stores. You can find cilantro, you can find scallions, and you can find some form of chili, if not serrano. You can find jalapeno, which works just great. Doesn't tend to have the same sweetness as a serrano, in my opinion, or the same level of heat. And you can get a relatively decent lime any time of the year. It's a simple glaze to make, and the fact that you make it ahead, it goes towards meal prepping as well. And you could even marinate the salmon ahead of time in the glaze. You know, you could do it a la menu, or you could marinate it. It really depends on your personal desire for how deep a flavor you want.
Is there a trick with salmon in a skillet or griddle versus, you know, broiling it or baking it?
I go 425 on an aluminum pizza pan with parchment paper, brushed with a little bit of olive oil.
Uh-huh.
That's my go-to. I've been doing salmon like that since I was 18 years old. I really enjoy it. It's so easy to do. Now, you can pan sear it, but you can get a lot of splatter. So anything I can do in an oven, I generally like to do in an oven. And I think I get great results. I get a better texture from the salmon in the oven because I get crispy edges and I get that kind of nice medium inside. But you could grill this just the same, and you could do this in a saute pan if you wanted to. You know, it's all a matter of how much and how assertive of the heat you want to put out there on the salmon. And that's going to determine, one, how firm it gets, the depth of flavor for the most part.
Talk a bit about your choice of the herbs and the serrano chili. How do they complement each other, and how do they, you know, how do they work with salmon?
So I'm going to bring this into a couple things that I like about Asian food in particular,
mm-hmm.
Particularly Thai and Vietnamese and even Indian food. I enjoy the vibrancy of herbs and heat. Mm-hmm. I like the vibrancy of cilantro and Thai basil and other herbs, but I also like the heat of a really good pepper. I like serrano. I do like jalapeno. I like red Thai chilies. I like a lot of different fresh type flavors. I'm not very into the sambal leeks or the fermented, you know, bean paste that are relatively spicy. I like the vibrant, fresh stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So with this salad that's on top of this, it's cilantro leaves, and that's quite a bit, 4 cups. It's got some shaved scallions, which, again, if you like Japanese food, Japanese people love scallions. And I went to culinary school with 20 Japanese students, so I got to know Japanese food quite well. And I really enjoy I enjoy scallions on top of food. It's a nice, light onion flavor, rather fresh. I use both the white and the green parts. And I do like to cut them, so there's a lot of surface area. So I cut them on what's a bias, which is a diagonal cut across the scallion. And then I like the chili for the heat, and I like the lime juice as the acid that kind of brings all that together.
Mm.
And the great thing about that salad is I take a little bit of that glaze, and I drizzle it in the salad greens, and I mix that with that chili and that lime juice and the herbs and the scallions.
Wow, I like that idea of saving some of the teriyaki, maple teriyaki sauce for the salad. Yeah, oof. Really sounds good.
Yeah, because we have it on hand. It makes a great salad dressing. I mean, when we get into the glaze component of this recipe, I mean, it really is incredibly versatile. Yeah. So,
well, let's talk about that glaze, because it's maple syrup season, and this is a sweet, savory sort of glaze?
Yeah, so it's kind of like the Italian agrodolce. There's some sweetness from the maple syrup. There's some acidity from the vinegar, from the rice vinegar. There's that saltiness from the tamari sauce. Which is just a Japanese naturally fermented soy sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's that kind of brightness of the sake. So it is that sweet, sour, kind of acidic blend of things. And it's the difference between teriyaki and soy sauce. And many people probably won't be able to know that, except soy sauce is a deeper, richer, more umami, earthy flavor. And teriyaki is a little bit lighter with a little bit of citrus, a little bit of, I would say, floral notes, and a little bit sweeter. So I think the maple syrup stands out. I choose tamari over soy sauce because it's lighter in depth, and it so it's not as deep in flavor. And it just tends to allow the maple to stand out a little bit more. And the maple is actually what gives this dish the body of the glaze. So as you reduce it and cook it down, the maple syrup is what will thicken and evaporate out its water and combine everything to it. It will actually pull the other three ingredients to it and become homogenous.
I love the simplicity of it, and I also love the versatility of this too, because as you say, try it on the salmon recipe, chicken, even you say nuts and steamed rice, and it's great.
Everything. I mean, it's a condiment now. So
yeah.
Now it's no different than soy sauce. What would you put soy sauce on? Uh-huh. What would you put ponzu on? What would you put? I mean, this is pretty much a maple form of ponzu minus the citrus. You're putting maple instead of it. But yeah, it's great. It's a great marinade. You put chicken thighs in there overnight. You take them out, pat them dry, you grill them or you broil them, and they're fantastic. You take chicken breasts, salmon, shrimp, scallops. They're wonderful on scallops. And then you take them, pat them dry, and sear them, and just drizzle a little of the glaze on top of that in the pan, and it thickens up, and you can pour that over the scallops on a dish. It's wonderful. You can put it in a little misting bottle, and you can make it a salad dressing. I think it goes well with radicchio, escarole, some almonds.
Well, listen, Curtis, thank you. This is really fun. This is really good. I got to try this because I've got some maple syrup and love salmon. So I got to try this recipe. It sounds excellent.
I think in a month we should check back in and see how many times you've used this recipe.
I'm thinking maybe like popcorn.
I think you could. I think it would be fantastic.
Chef Curtis Hem lives in Peru, New York, where he runs the Carriage House Cooking School. He's the executive chef at the View Restaurant at the Mirror Lake Inn Resort and Spa in Lake Placid, and joins us each month to share a favorite recipe.
You're delightful, Todd. I always appreciate your conversations with Chef Curtis. Well, you're listening to Northern Light right here on North Country Public Radio. It's about 8:27. Good morning. I'm Monica Sandreski here with Todd Moe and the one and only David Summerstein. How's
Good
it going?
Good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
It's great. And I came because I wanted to talk about an awesome thing that's happening on Friday in Potsdam. The Crane Latin Ensemble is playing, and they're doing it in a new format. So the Crane Latin Ensemble, let me tell you a little bit about them. They're, you know, Crane School of Music students at SUNY Potsdam, super talented young musicians who play like straight Latin jazz and salsa. And they're so fun. They've been around for years and years and years, you know, different students coming and going, led by Dr. Peter McCoy is the director. And they just play like hot, fun, awesome music.
That's great.
And this time they're going to be playing in like an open room. Like usually they'll play like in one of their theaters or something where you're sitting down. That's really hard when it's dance music, right?
Yeah.
So they're going to be playing in Knowles. It's called Knowles Hall. And it's like a big open room that allows for dancing for music like this. So this is Arturo Farrell. They're also going to be playing some Tito Puente, Oscar Hernandez. It is on Friday at 7:30 in the Knowles Hall multipurpose room on the SUNY Potsdam campus. Crane School of Music, Latin Jazz Ensemble.
Well, and I think what I appreciate hearing from Peter McCoy, too, that he was like, we play dance music. There's got to be dancing.
There's got to be dancing. You can't just do it in a theater.
And of course, you, as our fearless leader of hosting dance parties, I knew you'd appreciate this.
So fun. And you can, you know, learn how to dance salsa there. Just look around and see other people. They'll be happy to help. And it's free, family friendly, open to the public. Really good time. Oh, and they even say there's tables for resting and chatting.
No, I saw that too. Like, they get it.
Exactly, they get it. All right. So that's Friday, this Friday at 7:30, Knowles Hall, multi-purpose room on the SUNY Potsdam campus, the Crane Latin Ensemble.
Right on.
I want to go.
I know. I'm going to ask Lizette to come. She's going to have a great time.
Yes, totally.
David, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks,
appreciate it.
That's Northern Light for this Wednesday, March 6th. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Be well.